is ideal for big game hunters, where two rules hold. A. Your hunts are usually unsuccessful. And B. When they are successful, you typically have more meat than your family can consume, so you might as well share it around. As has been said, an HG's best investment against future hunger is to put meat in other people's stomachs now. Avoidance of despotism. As also covered in the next chapter, there's considerable evolutionary pressure for detecting cheating when someone reneges on their half of a reciprocal relationship. For nomadic HGs, policing covert cheating is less of a concern than overt evidence of intimidation and power-mongering. HGs are constantly on guard against bullies throwing their weight around. HG societies expend lots of collective effort on enforcing fairness, indirect reciprocity, and avoidance of despotism. This is accomplished with that terrific norm enforcement mechanism, gossip. HGs gossip endlessly, and as studied by Polly Wiesner of the University of Utah, it's mostly about the usual. Norm violation by high-status individuals. People magazine around the campfire. Gossiping serves numerous purposes. It helps for reality testing. Is it just me, or was he being a total jerk? Passing news? Two guesses who just happened to get a foot cramp during the hairiest part of the hunt today. And building consensus. Something needs to be done about this guy. Gossip is the weapon of norm enforcement. HG cultures take similar actions, collectively subjecting miscreants to criticism, shaming and mockery, ostracizing and shunning, refusing to share meat, non-lethal physical punishment, expulsion from the group, or, as a last resort, killing the person, done either by the whole group or by a designated executioner. Boehm documents such judicial killings in nearly half the pure HG cultures. What transgressions merit them? Murder, attempts at grabbing power, use of malicious sorcery, stealing, refusal to share, betrayal of the group to outsiders, and of course, breaking of sexual taboos. All typically punished this way after other interventions have failed repeatedly. So, Hobbes or Rousseau? Well, a mixture of the two, I say unhelpfully. This lengthy section makes clear that you have to make some careful distinctions. A. HGs versus other traditional ways of making a living. B. Nomadic HGs versus sedentary ones. C. Data sets that canvas an entire literature versus those that concentrate on extreme examples. D. Members of traditional societies killing one another versus members being killed by gun-toting, land-grabbing outsiders. E. Chimps as our cousins versus chimps erroneously viewed as our ancestors. F. Chimps as our closest ancestors versus chimps and bonobos as our closest ancestors. G. Warfare versus homicide, where lots of the former can decrease the latter in the name of in-group cooperation. H. Contemporary HGs living in stable, resource-filled habitats with minimal interactions with the outside world versus contemporary HGs pushed into marginal habitats and interacting with non-HGs. Once you've done that, I think a pretty clear answer emerges. The HGs who peopled Earth for hundreds of thousands of years were probably no angels, being perfectly capable of murder. However, war, both in the sense that haunts our modern world and in the stripped-down sense that haunted our ancestors, seems to have been rare until most humans abandoned the nomadic HG lifestyle. Our history as a species has not been soaked in escalated conflict, and ironically, Keeley tacitly concludes the same. He estimates that 90-95% of societies engage in war. And whom does he note as the exceptions? Nomadic HGs. Which brings us to agriculture. I won't pull any punches. I think that its invention was one of the all-time human blunders, up there with, say, the new Coke debacle and the Edsel. Agriculture makes people dependent on a few domesticated crops and animals instead of hundreds of wild food sources. creating vulnerability to droughts and blights and zoonotic diseases. Agriculture makes for sedentary living, leading humans to do something that no primate with a concern for hygiene and public health would ever do, namely living in close proximity to their feces. Agriculture makes for surplus, and thus almost inevitably the unequal distribution of surplus, generating socioeconomic status differences that dwarf anything that other primates cook up with their hierarchies. And from there, it's just a hop, skip, and a jump until we've got Mr. McGregor persecuting Peter Rabbit and people incessantly singing Oklahoma. Maybe this is a bit over the top. Nonetheless, I do think it is reasonably clear that it wasn't until humans began the massive transformation of life that came from domesticating Teosinthian wild tubers, owl rocks, and einkorn, and of course wolves, that it became possible to let loose the dogs of war. Some conclusions. The first half of the chapter explored where we are. The second, how we most likely got here. Where we are is awash in cultural variation. From our biological perspective, the most fascinating point is how brains shape cultures, which shape brains, which shape... That's why it's called co-evolution. We've seen some evidence of co-evolution in the technical sense, where there are significant differences between different cultures in the distribution of gene variants pertinent to behavior. But those influences are pretty small. Instead, what is most consequential is childhood, the time when cultures inculcate individuals into further propagating their culture. In that regard, probably the most important fact about genetics and culture is the delayed maturation of the frontal cortex, the genetic programming for the young frontal cortex to be freer from genes than other brain regions, to be sculpted instead by environment, to sop up cultural norms. To hark back to a theme from the first pages of this book, it doesn't take a particularly fancy brain to learn how to motorically, say, throw a punch. But it takes a fancy, environmentally malleable frontal cortex to learn culture-specific rules about when it's okay to throw punches. In another theme from the first half, cultural differences manifest themselves in monumentally important, expected ways. Say, whom it is okay to kill, an enemy soldier, a cheating spouse, a newborn of the wrong sex, an elderly parent too old to hunt, a teenage daughter who is absorbing the culture around her rather than the culture her parents departed. But the manifestations can occur in unlikely places, e.g., where your eyes look within milliseconds of seeing a picture, or whether thinking of a rabbit prompts you to think of other animals or of what rabbits eat. Another key theme is the paradoxical influence of ecology. Ecosystems majorly shape culture. But then that culture can be exported and persist in radically different places for millennia. Stated most straightforwardly, most of Earth's humans have inherited their beliefs about the nature of birth and death and everything in between and thereafter from pre-literate Middle Eastern pastoralists. The second half of the chapter, just concluded, addresses the key issue of how we got here. Has it been hundreds of thousands of years of Hobbes or of Rousseau? Your answer to that question greatly shapes what you'll make of something we'll consider in the final chapter. Namely, that over the last half millennium, people have arguably gotten a lot less awful to one another. Chapter 10. The Evolution of Behavior. At last we reach the foundations. Genes and promoters evolve, as do transcription factors, transposases, and splicing enzymes, as has every trait touched by genetic influences, i.e., everything. In the words of the geneticist Theodosius Dobzhansky, nothing in biology makes sense except in the light of evolution, including this book. Evolution 101. Evolution rests on three steps. A. Certain biological traits are inherited by genetic means. B. Mutations and gene recombination produce variation in those traits. C. Some of those variants confer more fitness than others. Given those conditions, over time, the frequency of more fit gene variants increases in a population. We start by trashing some common misconceptions. First, that evolution favors survival of the fittest. Instead, evolution is about reproduction, passing on copies of genes. An organism living centuries but not reproducing is evolutionarily invisible. The difference between survival and reproduction is shown with antagonistic pleiotropy, referring to traits that increase reproductive fitness early in life, yet decrease lifespan. For example, primates' prostates have high metabolic rates, enhancing sperm motility. Upside, enhanced fertility. Downside, increased risk of prostate cancer. Antagonistic pleiotropy occurs dramatically in salmon, who epically journey to their spawning grounds to reproduce and then die. If evolution were about survival, rather than passing on copies of genes, there'd be no antagonistic pleiotropy. Another misconception is that evolution can select for pre-adaptations, neutral traits that prove useful in the future. This doesn't happen. Selection is for traits pertinent to the present. Related to this is the misconception that living species are somehow better adapted than extinct species. Instead, the latter were just as well adapted until environmental conditions changed sufficiently to do them in. The same awaits us. Finally, there's the misconception that evolution directionally selects for greater complexity. Yes, if once there were only single-celled organisms and there are multicellular ones now, average complexity has increased. Nonetheless, evolution doesn't necessarily select for greater complexity. Just consider bacteria decimating humans with some plague. The final misconception is that evolution is just a theory. I will boldly assume that readers who have gotten this far believe in evolution. Opponents inevitably bring up that irritating canard that evolution is unproven because, following an unuseful convention in the field, it is a theory, like, say, germ theory. Evidence for the reality of evolution includes numerous examples where changing selective pressures have changed gene frequencies in populations within generations, e.g., bacteria evolving antibiotic resistance. Moreover, there are also examples, mostly insects, given their short generation times, of a species in the process of splitting into two. Voluminous fossil evidence of intermediate forms in numerous taxonomic lineages. Molecular evidence. We share roughly 98% of our genes with the other apes, roughly 96% with monkeys, roughly 75% with dogs, roughly 20% with fruit flies. This indicates that our last common ancestor with other apes lived more recently than our last common ancestor with monkeys, and so on. Geographic evidence. To use Richard Dawkins' suggestion for dealing with a fundamentalist insisting that all species emerged in their current forms from Noah's Ark, how come all 37 species of lemurs that made landfall on Mount Ararat in the Armenian highlands hiked over to Madagascar, none dying and leaving fossils in transit? Unintelligent design. Oddities explained only by evolution. Why do whales and dolphins have vestigial leg bones? Because they descend from a four-legged terrestrial mammal. Why should we have erector pili muscles in our skin that produce thoroughly useless goose flesh? Because of our recent speciation from other apes whose erector pili muscles were attached to hair and whose hair stands up during emotional arousal. Enough. Don't get me started. Evolution sculpts the traits of an organism in two broad ways. Sexual selection selects for traits that attract members of the opposite sex. Natural selection for traits that enhance the passing on of copies of genes through any other route, e.g. good health, foraging skills, predator avoidance. The two processes can work in opposition. For example, among wild sheep, one gene influences the size of horns in males. One variant produces large horns, improving social dominance, a plus for sexual selection. The other produces small horns, which are metabolically cheaper, allowing males to live and mate, albeit at low rates, longer. Which wins? Transient but major reproductive success, or persistent but minor success? An intermediate form. Or consider male peacocks paying a price, in terms of natural selection, for their garish plumage. It costs a fortune metabolically to grow, restricts mobility, and is conspicuous to predators, but it sure boosts fitness via sexual selection. Importantly, neither type of selection necessarily selects for the most adaptive version of a trait, which replaces all others. There can be frequency-dependent selection, where the rarer version of two traits is preferable, or balanced selection, where multiple versions of traits are maintained in equilibrium. Behavior can be shaped by evolution. Organisms are amazingly well adapted. A desert rodent has kidneys that excel at retaining water. A giraffe's huge heart can pump blood up to its brain. Elephants' leg bones are strong enough to support an elephant. Well, yes, it has to work that way. Desert rodents whose kidneys weren't great at retaining water didn't pass on copies of their genes. Thus, there is a logic to evolution, where natural selection sculpts traits into adaptiveness. Importantly, natural selection works not only on anatomy and physiology, but on behavior as well. In other words, behavior evolves, can be optimized by selection into being adaptive. Various branches of biology focus on the evolution of behavior. Probably best known is sociobiology, premised on social behavior being sculpted by evolution to be optimized, just as biomechanical optimization sculpts the size of a giraffe's heart. Sociobiology emerged in the 1970s, eventually generating the offshoot evolutionary psychology, the study of the evolutionary optimization of psychological traits. As we'll see, both have been plenty controversial. As a simplifying convenience, I'll refer to people who study the evolution of social behavior as sociobiologists. The demise of group selection. We start by grappling with an entrenched misconception about the evolution of behavior. This is because Americans were taught about the subject in the 1960s by Marlon Perkins on the TV program Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom. It was great. Perkins would host. Jim, his sidekick, did dangerous things with snakes. And there were always seamless segues from the program to ads from Mutual of Omaha. Just as lions mate for hours, you'll want fire insurance for your home. Unfortunately, Perkins espoused wildly wrong evolutionary thinking. Here's how it looked on the program. It's dawn on the savannah. There's a herd of wildebeest on a river's edge. The grass is greener on the other side, and everyone wants some. But the river teems with predatory crocodiles. The wildebeest are hemming and hawing in agitation when suddenly an elderly wildebeest pushes to the front, says, "I sacrifice myself for you, my children," and leaps in. And while the crocs are busy with him, the other wildebeest cross the river. Why would the old wildebeest do that? Marlon Perkins would answer with patrician authority, "Because animals behave for the good of the species." Yes, behavior evolves by group selection for the good of the species. This idea was championed in the early 1960s by V.C. Wynne Edwards, whose wrongness made him modern evolutionary biology's Lamarck. Animals don't behave for the good of the species. But what about that wildebeest? Look closely and you'll see what really happens. Why did he wind up saving the day? Because he was old and weak. Good of the species, my keister. They pushed the old guy in. Group selection was done in by theoretical and empirical studies showing patterns of behavior incompatible with it. Key work was done by two gods of evolutionary biology, George Williams of SUNY Stony Brook and Oxford's Bill W.D. Hamilton. Consider eusocial insects, where most individuals are non-reproductive workers. Why forego reproduction to aid the queen? Group selection, obviously. Hamilton showed that eusocial insects' unique genetic system makes a colony of ants, bees, or termites a single superorganism. Asking why worker ants forgo reproduction is like asking why your nose cells forgo reproduction. In other words, Eusocial insects constitute a unique type of group. Williams then elaborated on how the more standard genetic system, in species from non-eusocial insects to us, was incompatible with group selection. Animals don't behave for the good of the species. They behave to maximize the number of copies of their genes passed into the next generation. Footnote. The unique feature of the eusocial insect genetic system is that a sterile worker passes on more copies of her genes by helping the queen to reproduce than by reproducing herself. Meanwhile, the eusocial insect world has been shaken up by the fact that in some species, e.g. termites, there is a more conventional genetic system in place. People are still sorting that one out. This is the cornerstone of sociobiology and was summarized in Dawkins's famed soundbite that evolution is about selfish genes. Time to see its building blocks. Individual selection. Passing on lots of copies of one's genes is accomplished most directly by maximizing reproduction. This is summarized by the aphorism, "A chicken is an egg's way of making another egg. Behavior is just an epiphenomenon, a means of getting copies of genes into the next generation." Individual selection fares better than group selection in explaining basic behaviors. A hyena bears down on some zebras. What would the nearest one do if she's a group selectionist? Stand there, sacrificing herself for the group. In contrast, an individual selectionist zebra would run like hell. Zebras run like hell. Or consider hyenas that have just killed a zebra. Group selection mindset? Everyone calmly takes turns eating. Individual selection? Frenzied free-for-all. Which is what occurs. But wait, says the group selectionist. Wouldn't the zebra species benefit if it is the fastest animals who survive and pass on those fast-running genes? Ditto for the group benefits of the fiercest hyena getting the most food. As more nuances of behavior are observed, clinging to group selection requires increasingly tortuous arguments. But one single observation devastates group selection. In 1977, the Harvard primatologist Sarah Blaffer Hurdy documented something remarkable. Langur monkeys in the Mount Abu region of India kill one another. People already knew that some male primates kill one another, fighting for dominance. Okay, makes sense. Boys will be boys. But that's not what Hurdy reported. Male langurs were killing infants. Once people believed her careful documentation, there was an easy answer. Since babies are cute and inhibit aggression, something pathological must be happening. Maybe the Abu langur population density was too high and everyone was starving. Or male aggression was overflowing. Or infanticidal males were zombies. Something certifiably abnormal. Hurdy eliminated these explanations and showed a telling pattern to the infanticide. Female langurs live in groups with a single resident breeding male. Elsewhere are all male groups that intermittently drive out the resident male. After infighting, one male then drives out the rest. Here's his new domain, consisting of females with the babies of the previous male. And crucially, the average tenure of a breeding male, about 27 months, is shorter than the average interbirth interval. No females are ovulating because they're nursing infants. Thus, this new stud will be booted out himself before any females wean their kids and resume ovulating. All for nothing. None of his genes passed on. What logically should he do? Kill the infants. This decreases the reproductive success of the previous male and, thanks to the females ceasing to nurse, they start ovulating. That's the male perspective. What about the females? They're also into maximizing copies of genes passed on. They fight the new male, protecting their infants. Females have also evolved the strategy of going into pseudoestrus, falsely appearing to be in heat. They mate with the male. And since males know squat about female langur biology, they fall for it. Hey, I mated with her this morning, and now she's got an infant. I am one major stud. They'll often cease their infanticidal attacks. Despite initial skepticism, competitive infanticide has been documented in similar circumstances in 119 species, including lions, hippos, and chimps. A variant occurs in hamsters. Because males are nomadic, any infant a male encounters is unlikely to be his, and thus he attempts to kill it. Remember that rule about never putting a pet male hamster in a cage with babies? Another version occurs among wild horses and gelada baboons. A new male harasses pregnant females into miscarrying. Or suppose you're a pregnant mouse and a new infanticidal male has arrived. Once you give birth, your infants will be killed, wasting all the energy of pregnancy. Logical response? Cut your losses with the Bruce effect, where pregnant females miscarry if they smell a new male. Thus, competitive infanticide occurs in numerous species, including among female chimps, who sometimes kill infants of unrelated females. None of this makes sense outside of gene-based individual selection. Individual selection is shown with heartbreaking clarity by mountain gorillas, my favorite primate. They're highly endangered, hanging on in pockets of high-altitude rainforest on the borders of Uganda, Rwanda, and the Democratic Republic of the Congo. There are only about 1,000 gorillas left because of habitat degradation, disease caught from nearby humans, poaching, and spasms of warfare rolling across those borders. And also because mountain gorillas practice competitive infanticide. Logical for an individual intent on maximizing the copies of his genes in the next generation, but simultaneously pushing these wondrous animals toward extinction. This isn't behaving for the good of the species. Kin selection. To understand the next foundational concept, reflect on what it means to be related to someone and to pass on copies of your genes. Suppose you have an identical twin with the same genome as you. As a startling, irrefutable fact, in terms of the genes being passed on to the next generation, it doesn't matter if you reproduce or sacrifice yourself so that your twin reproduces. What about a full sibling who isn't an identical twin? Recall from Chapter 8 that you'd share 50% of your genes with him. Thus, reproducing once and dying so that he reproduces twice are evolutionarily identical. Half-sibling, 25% of genes in common, calculate accordingly. The geneticist J.B.S. Haldane, who, when asked if he'd sacrifice his life for a brother, is credited to have quipped, "I'll gladly lay down my life for two brothers or eight cousins." You can leave copies of your genes in the next generation by reproducing, but also by helping relatives reproduce, especially closer relatives. Hamilton formalized this with an equation factoring in the costs and benefits of helping someone, weighted by their degree of relatedness to you. This is the essence of kin selection. Footnote. Also known as inclusive fitness, because a gene-based focus includes not only direct reproductive success, Darwinian fitness, but also payoffs derived from the success of other relatives, weighted by the degree of relatedness. This explains the crucial fact that in countless species, whom you cooperate with, compete with, or mate with depends on their degree of relatedness to you. Mammals first encounter kin selection soon after birth, reflecting something monumentally obvious. Females rarely nurse someone else's infants. Next, among numerous primates, the mother of a newborn and an adolescent female may commence a relationship fraught with pluses and minuses. The mother occasionally lets the adolescent care for her offspring. For the mother, the plus is getting time to forage without baby on board. The minus is that the babysitter may be incompetent. For the adolescent, the plus is getting mothering experience. The minus, the effort of childcare. Lynn Fairbanks of UCLA has quantified the pluses and minuses of such allo-mothering, including that adolescents who practiced mothering have a better survival rate for their own kids. And who is a frequent allo-mother? The female's kid sister. An extension of allo-mothering is the cooperative breeding of New World monkeys like marmosets. In their social groups, only one female breeds, while the others, typically younger relatives, help with childcare. The extent to which a male primate cares for infants reflects his certainty of paternity. Among marmosets, who form stable pair bonds, males do most of the child care. In contrast, among baboons, where a female mates with multiple males during her estrus cycle, it's only the likely fathers, i.e., males who mated on the female's most fertile day, when she had her most conspicuous estrus swelling, who invest in the well-being of the child, aiding him in a fight. Among many primates, how often you groom someone depends on how closely related they are to you. Among baboons, females spend their whole life in their natal troop, whereas males migrate to a new troop at puberty. As a result, adult females have complex cooperative kinship relations and inherit their dominance rank from their mother. Among chimps, it's the opposite. Females leave home at puberty, and kin-based adult cooperation occurs only among males. For example, where groups of related males attack solitary males from neighboring groups. And among langurs, when a female defends her infant against a new male, she most often is helped by elderly female relatives. Moreover, primates understand kinship. Dorothy Cheney and Robert Seyfarth of the University of Pennsylvania, studying wild vervet monkeys, have shown that if animal A is crummy to animal B, afterward, B is more likely to be crummy to A's relatives. And if A is lousy to B, B's relatives are more likely to be crummy to A. Furthermore, if A is lousy to B, B's relatives are more likely to be crummy to A's relatives. In beautiful playback experiments, Cheney and Seyfarth first recorded vocalizations from each vervet in a group. They'd place a speaker in some bushes, and when everyone was sitting around, they'd play a recording of some kid giving a distress call. And the females would all look at the kid's mother. Hey, that's Madge's kid. What's she going to do? Note that this also shows that monkeys recognize voices. In a study of wild baboons, Cheney and Seyfarth would wait for two unrelated females to sit near the bush with a speaker, and then play one of three vocalizations. A. Sounds of the two females' relatives fighting with each other. B. A relative of one fighting with a third party. C. Two other random females fighting. If a female's relative was involved in the fighting, she'd look toward the speaker longer than if there were no relatives involved. And if it was relatives of the two females fighting each other, the higher-ranking one would remind the subordinate of her place by supplanting her from her spot. Another playback study created some baboon virtual reality. Baboon A dominates baboon B. Thanks to cutting and splicing of recordings of vocalizations, baboon A is heard making a dominance vocalization, B making a subordination one. When this happens, no baboons looked at the bushes. A is greater than B, boring status quo. But if baboon A is heard making a subordination vocalization after B makes a dominance one, a rank reversal, everyone orients to the bushes. Did you hear what I just heard? Then a third scenario. A dominance reversal between two members of the same family. And no one looks because it's uninteresting. Families, they're crazy. You should see mine. We have these huge dominance reversals and are hugging an hour later. Baboons classify others simultaneously according to both individual rank and kinship. Thus, other primates contemplate kinship with remarkable sophistication, with kinship determining patterns of cooperation and competition. Non-primates are also into kin selection. Consider this. Sperm in a female's vaginal tract can aggregate, allowing them to swim faster. Among a deer mouse species where females mate with multiple males, sperm aggregate only with sperm from the same individual or a close relative. As behavioral examples, squirrels and prairie dogs give alarm vocalizations when spotting a predator. It's risky. Calling attention to the caller, and such altruism is more common when in the proximity of relatives. Social groups built around female relatives occur in numerous species, e.g. lion prides, where related females nurse one another's cubs. Moreover, while prides typically contain a single breeding male, on those occasions when it's two males, better than chance that they're brothers. there is a striking similarity in humans. Most cultures have historically allowed polygyny, with monogamy as the rarer beast. Even rarer is polyandry, multiple men married to one woman. This occurs in northern India, Tibet, and Nepal, where the polyandry is adelphic, aka fraternal. A woman marries all the brothers of one family, from the strapping young man to his infant brother. Footnote. Such fraternal polyandry occurs in resource-poor regions, basically acting as a means to decrease population growth and prevent family plots from winding up being below subsistence level when subdivided and inherited among all the sons in a family. Instead, all the brothers are married to the one woman, who has equal sexual access to all of them. The brothers believe that all of them, down to their infant brother, are equally biologically responsible for the children. A challenging implication of kin selection arises. Those hot cousins. If one accrues fitness benefits by helping relatives pass on copies of their genes, why not help them do that by mating with them? Yuck. Inbreeding produces decreased fertility and those genetic unpleasantnesses in European royalty. So the dangers of inbreeding counter the kin selection advantages. Theoretical models suggest that the optimal balance is third cousin matings. And indeed, numerous species prefer to mate with between a first and a third cousin. This occurs in insects, lizards, and fish, where, on top of that, cousin mating pairs invest more in the rearing of their offspring than do unrelated parents. A preference for cousin matings occurs in quail, frigate birds, and zebra finches, while among pair-bonded barn swallows and ground tits, females sneak out on their partner to mate with cousins. Similar preferences occur in some rodents, including the Malagasy giant jumping rat, a species that sounds disturbing even without cousins shacking up with each other. And what about humans? Something similar. Women prefer the smell of moderately related over unrelated men. And in a study of 160 years of data concerning every couple in Iceland, which is a mecca for human geneticists, given its genetic and socioeconomic homogeneity, the highest reproductive success arose from third and fourth cousin marriages. Recognizing relatives? These findings concerning kin selection require animals to recognize degrees of relatedness. How do they do this? Some species have innate recognition. For example, place a mouse in an arena. At one end is an unrelated female, at the other, a full sister from a different litter never encountered before. The mouse spends more time with the sister, suggesting genetically based kin recognition. How does this work? Rodents produce pheromonal odors with individual signatures, derived from genes called the Major Histocompatibility Complex, MHC. This is a supervariable gene cluster that produces unique proteins that form a signature for an individual. This was first studied by immunologists. What does the immune system do? It differentiates between you and invaders, self and non-self, and attacks the latter. All your cells carry your unique MHC-derived protein, and surveillance immune cells attack any cell lacking this protein password. And MHC-derived proteins also wind up in pheromones, producing a distinctive olfactory signature. This system can indicate that this mouse is John Smith. How does it also tell that he's your never-before-encountered brother? The closer the relative, the more similar their cluster of MHC genes and the more similar their olfactory signature. Olfactory neurons in a mouse contain receptors that respond most strongly to the mouse's own MHC protein. Thus, if the receptor is maximally stimulated, it means the mouse is sniffing its armpit. If near maximally stimulated, it's a close relative. Moderately, a distant relative. Not at all, though the MHC protein is being detected by other olfactory receptors, it's a hippo's armpit. Footnote. Not all olfactory kin recognition is based on MHC proteins. There are numerous other sources of an individual olfactory signature. Note also how this can explain the kin selection phenomenon mentioned earlier, where sperm form cooperative swimming aggregates only with sperm from the same individual or a close relative. How to pull this off? Use the MHC proteins on the surface of the sperm as Velcro. If two sperm have identical proteins, i.e. they're from the same person, they aggregate very tightly. Close relative, not as tightly, but still pretty tightly. More distant relative, less tightly, etc. Olfactory recognition of kin accounts for a fascinating phenomenon. Recall from Chapter 5 how the adult brain makes new neurons. In rats, pregnancy triggers neurogenesis in the olfactory system. Why there? So that olfactory recognition is in top form when it's time to recognize your newborn. If the neurogenesis doesn't occur, maternal behavior is impaired. Then there is kin recognition based on imprinted sensory cues. How do I know which newborn to nurse? The one who smells like my vaginal fluid. Which kid do I hang out near? The one who smells like mom's milk. Many ungulates use such rules. So do birds. Which bird do I know is mom? The bird whose distinctive song I learned before hatching. And there are species that figure out relatedness by reasoning. My guess is that male baboons make statistical inferences when identifying their likely offspring. How much of this mom's peak estrus swelling was spent with me? All. Okay, this is my kid. Act accordingly. Which brings us to the most cognitively strategic species, namely us. How do we do kin recognition? In ways that are far from accurate, with interesting consequences. We start with a long-theorized type of pseudo-kin recognition. What if you operate with the rule that you cooperate with, i.e., act related to, individuals who share conspicuous traits with you? This facilitates passing on copies of genes if you possess a gene or genes with three properties. A. It generates that conspicuous signal. B. Recognizes it in others. And C. Makes you cooperate with others who have that signal. It's a kind of primitive, stripped-down kin selection. Hamilton speculated about the existence of such a green beard effect. If an organism has a gene that codes for both growing a green beard and cooperating with other green bearders will flourish when mixed with non-green bearders. Thus, the crucial requirement for altruism is genetic relatedness at the altruism locus, i.e., merely a multifaceted green beard gene, and not genealogical relationship over the whole genome. Green beard genes exist. Among yeast, cells form cooperative aggregates that need not be identical or even closely related. Instead, it could be any yeast that expresses a gene coding for a cell surface adhesion protein that sticks to copies of the same molecule on other cells. Humans show green beard effects. Crucially, we differ as to what counts as a green beard trait. Define it narrowly, and we call it parochialism. Include enmity toward those without that green beard trait, and it's xenophobia. Define the green beard trait as being a member of your species, and you've described a deep sense of humanity. Reciprocal altruism. So sometimes a chicken is an egg's way of making another egg. Genes can be selfish, and sometimes we gladly lay down our lives for two brothers or eight cousins. Does everything have to be about competition, about individuals or groups of relatives leaving more copies of their genes than the others, being more fit, having more reproductive success? Is the driving force of behavioral evolution always that someone be vanquished? Not at all. One exception is elegant if specialized. Remember rock, paper, scissors? Paper envelops rock. Rock breaks scissors. Scissors cut paper. Would rocks want to bash every scissors into extinction? No way, because then all those papers would enwrap the rocks into extinction. Each participant has an incentive for restraint, producing an equilibrium. Remarkably, such equilibriums occur in living systems, as shown in a study of the bacteria Escherichia coli. The authors generated three colonies of E. coli, each with a strength and a weakness. To simplify, Strain 1 secretes a toxin. Strength, it can kill competitor cells. Weakness, making the toxin is energetically costly. Strain 2 is vulnerable to the toxin in that it has a membrane transporter that absorbs nutrients and the toxin slips in via that transporter. Strength, it's good at getting food. Weakness, vulnerability to the toxin. Strain 3 doesn't have the transporter and thus isn't vulnerable to the toxin, and it doesn't make the toxin. Strength, it doesn't bear the cost of making the toxin and is insensitive to it. Weakness, it doesn't absorb as much nutrients. Thus, destruction of strain 2 by strain 1 causes the demise of strain 1 thanks to strain 3. The study showed that the strains could exist in equilibrium, each limiting its growth. Cool. But it doesn't quite fit our intuitions about cooperation. Rock, paper, scissors is to cooperation as peace due to nuclear weapons-based mutually assured destruction is to the Garden of Eden. Which raises a third fundamental, alongside individual selection and kin selection. Reciprocal altruism. I'll scratch your back if you scratch mine. I'd rather not actually scratch yours if I can get away with it. And I'm watching you in case you try the same. Despite what you might expect from kin selection, unrelated animals frequently cooperate. Fish swarm in a school. Birds fly in formation. Meerkats take risks by giving alarm calls that aid everyone. Vampire bats who maintain communal colonies feed one another's babies. Footnote. This one is a bit controversial in that the bat colonies are often made up of somewhat related females, making way for a kin selection argument. Depending on the species, unrelated primates groom one another, mob predators, and share meat. Why should non-relatives cooperate? Because many hands lighten the load. School with other fish, and you're less likely to be eaten. Competition for the safest spot, the center, produces what Hamilton termed the geometry of the selfish herd. Birds flying in a V formation save energy by catching the updraft of the bird in front, raising the question of who gets stuck there. If chimps groom one another, there are fewer parasites. In a key 1971 paper, biologist Robert Trivers laid out the evolutionary logic and parameters by which unrelated organisms engage in reciprocal altruism, incurring a fitness cost to enhance a non-relative's fitness with the expectation of reciprocation. It doesn't require consciousness to evolve reciprocal altruism. Back to the metaphor of the airplane wing in the wind tunnel. But there are some requirements for its occurrence. Obviously, the species must be social. Furthermore, social interactions have to be frequent enough that the altruist and the indebted are likely to encounter each other again. And individuals must be able to recognize each other. Amid reciprocal altruism occurring in numerous species, individuals often attempt to cheat, i.e., to not reciprocate, and monitor attempts by others to do the same to them. This raises the realpolitik world of cheating and counter-strategies, the two co-evolving and escalating arms races. This is called a Red Queen scenario, for the Red Queen in Through the Looking Glass, who must run faster and faster to stay in place. This raises two key interrelated questions. Amid the cold calculations of evolutionary fitness, when is it optimal to cooperate, when to cheat? In a world of non-cooperators, it's disadvantageous to be the first altruist. How do systems of cooperation ever start? Gigantic question number one. What strategy for cooperating is optimal? While biologists were formulating these questions, other scientists were already starting to answer them. In the 1940s, game theory was founded by the polymath John von Neumann, one of the fathers of computer science. Game theory is the study of strategic decision-making. Framed slightly differently, it's the mathematical study of when to cooperate and when to cheat. The topic was already being explored with respect to economics, diplomacy, and warfare. What was needed was for game theorists and biologists to start talking. This occurred around 1980 concerning the Prisoner's Dilemma, PD, introduced in Chapter 3. time to see its parameters in detail. Two members of a gang, A and B, are arrested. Prosecutors lack evidence to convict them of a major crime, but can get them on a lesser charge for which they'll serve a year in prison. A and B can't communicate with each other. Prosecutors offer each a deal. Inform on the other, and your sentence is reduced. There are four possible outcomes. Both A and B refuse to inform on each other. Each serves 1 year. Both A and B inform on each other. Each serves 2 years. A informs on B, who remains silent. A walks free, and B serves 3 years. B informs on A, who remains silent. B walks, and A serves 3 years. Thus, each prisoner's dilemma is whether to be loyal to your partner, cooperate, or betray him, defect. The thinking might go, best to cooperate. This is my partner. He'll also cooperate, and we'll each serve only a year. But what if I cooperate and he stabs me in the back? He walks, and I'm in for 3 years. Better defect. But what if we both defect? That's 2 years. But maybe defect in case he cooperates, round and round. If you play PD once, there is a rational solution. If you, prisoner A, defect, your sentence averages out to 1 year. 0 years if B cooperates, 2 years if B defects. If you cooperate, the average is 2 years. 1 year if B cooperates, 3 years if B defects. Thus, you should defect. In single-round versions of PD, it's always optimal to defect. Not very encouraging for the state of the world. Suppose there are 2 rounds of PD. The optimal strategy for the second round is just like in a single-round version, always defect. Given that, the first round defaults into being like a single-round game, and thus defect during it also. What about a 3-round game? Defect in the third, meaning that things default in a 2-round game, in which case defect in the second, meaning defect in the first. It's always optimal to defect in round Z, the final round, and thus it's always optimal to defect in round Z1, and thus round Z2. In other words, when two individuals play for a known number of rounds, the optimal strategy precludes cooperation. But what if the number of rounds is unknown, an iterated PD? Things get interesting, which is when the game theorists and biologists met. The catalyst was political scientist Robert Axelrod of the University of Michigan. He explained to his colleagues how PD works and asked them what strategy they'd use in a game with an unknown number of rounds. The strategies offered varied enormously, with some being hair-raisingly complicated. Axelrod then programmed the various strategies and pitted them against each other in a simulated massive round-robin tournament. Which strategy won was most optimal? It was provided by a mathematician at the University of Toronto, Anatole Rapoport. As the mythic path of the hero story goes, it was the simplest strategy. Cooperate in the first round. After that, you do whatever the other player did in the previous round. It was called tit for tat. More details. You cooperate, C, in the first round, and if the other player always cooperates, C, you both happily cooperate into the sunset. Example 1. You see, her see. 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 Suppose the other player starts cooperating, but then, tempted by Satan, defects, D, in round 10. You cooperated, and thus you take a hit. Example 2. You see her see, you see her see, you see her see, you see her see, you see her D. Thus, you tit for tat her, punishing her in the next round. Example 3. You see her see, you see her see, you see her see, you see her see, you see her D, you D. If by then she's resumed cooperating, you do as well. peace returns. Example 4. You see Hersey, you see Hersey, you see her D, you D her C, you see Hersey, you see Hersey, you see Hersey. If she continues defecting, you do as well. Example 5. You see Hersey, you see her D, you D 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 her D. Suppose you play against someone who always defects. Things look like this. Example 6. You see her D, you D her D, you D her D, you D her D, you D her D. This is the tit-for-tat strategy. Note that it can never win. Best case is a draw if playing against another person using tit-for-tat or someone using an always-cooperate strategy. Otherwise, it loses by a small margin. Every other strategy would always beat tit-for-tat by a small margin. However, other strategies playing against each other can produce catastrophic losses. And when everything is summed, tit-for-tat wins. It lost nearly every battle, but won the war. Or rather, the peace. In other words, tit-for-tat drives other strategies to extinction. Tit-for-tat has 4 things going for it. Its proclivity is to cooperate, i.e., that's its starting state. But it isn't a sucker and punishes defectors. It's forgiving. If the defector resumes cooperating, so will tit-for-tat. And the strategy is simple. Axelrod's tournament launched a zillion papers about tit-for-tat in PD and related games, more later. Then something crucial occurred. Axelrod and Hamilton hooked up. Biologists studying the evolution of behavior long to be as quantitative as those studying the evolution of kidneys in desert rats. And here was this world of social scientists studying this very topic, even if they didn't know it. PD provided a framework for thinking about the strategic evolution of cooperation and competition, as Axelrod and Hamilton explored in a 1981 paper, famous enough that it's a buzz phrase, e.g., "How'd your lecture go today?" "Terrible, way behind schedule, I didn't even get to Axelrod and Hamilton." As the evolutionary biologists started hanging with the political scientists, they inserted real-world possibilities into game scenarios. One addressed a flaw in tit-for-tat. Let's introduce signal errors. A message is misunderstood. Someone forgets to tell someone something, or there's a hiccup of noise in the system, like in the real world. There has been a signal error in round 5 with 2 individuals using a tit-for-tat strategy. This is what everyone means. Example 7. You see her see. 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 But thanks to a signal error, this is what you think happened. Example 8. You see her see. You see her see. You see her see. You see her see. You see her D. You think, what a creep defecting like that. You defect in the next round. Thus, what you think has happened. Example 9. You see her see. You see her see. You see her see. You see her see. You see her D. You D her see. What she thinks is happening, being unaware of the signal error. You see her see. 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 You D her see. She thinks, what a creep defecting like that. Thus she defects the next round. Oh, so you want more? I'll give you more, you think, and defect. Oh, so you want more? I'll give you more, she thinks. Example 11. You see her D, you D, her C, you see her D, you D, her C, you see her D, you D, her C, you see her D, you D, her C. When signal errors are possible, a pair of tit-for-tat players are vulnerable to being locked forever into the seesawing of defection. The discovery of this vulnerability prompted evolutionary biologists Martin Novak of Harvard, Carl Sigmund of the University of Vienna, and Robert Boyd of UCLA to provide two solutions. Contrite tit-for-tat retaliates only if the other side has defected twice in a row. Forgiving tit-for-tat automatically forgives one-third of defections. Both avoid doomsday signal error scenarios, but are vulnerable to exploitation. A solution to this vulnerability is to shift the frequency of forgiveness in accordance with the likelihood of signal error. "Sorry, I'm late again. The train was delayed," being assessed as more plausible and forgivable than "Sorry, I'm late again. A meteorite hit my driveway again." Another solution to tit-for-tat signal error vulnerability is to use a shifting strategy. At the beginning, in an ocean of heterogeneous strategies, many heavily biased toward defection start with tit-for-tat. Once they've become extinct, switch to forgiving tit-for-tat, which outcompetes tit-for-tat when signal errors occur. What is this transition from hard-assed, punitive tit-for-tat to incorporating forgiveness? Establishing trust. Other elaborations simulate living systems. The computer scientist John Holland of the University of Michigan introduced genetic algorithms, strategies that mutate over time. Another real-world elaboration was to factor in the cost of certain strategies. For example, with tit-for-tat, the costs of monitoring for and then punishing cheating, costly alarm systems, police salaries, and jail construction. These are superfluous in a world of no signal errors and nothing but tit-for-tatters, and tit-for-tat can be replaced by the cheaper, always cooperate. Thus, when there are signal errors, differing costs to different strategies, and the existence of mutations, a cycle emerges. A heterogeneous population of strategies, including exploitative, non-cooperative ones, are replaced by tit-for-tat, then replaced by forgiving tit-for-tat, then by always cooperate, until a mutation reintroduces an exploitative strategy that spreads like wildfire. A wolf among always cooperate sheep, starting the cycle all over again. More and more modifications made the models closer to the real world. Soon the computerized game strategies were having sex with each other, which must have been the most exciting thing ever for the mathematicians involved. The evolutionary biologists were delighted to generate increasingly sophisticated models with the theoretical economists and theoretical diplomats and theoretical war strategists. The real question was whether animal behavior actually fits any of these models. One bizarre animal system suggests tit-for-tat enforcement of cooperation involving the black hamlet fish, which forms stable pair bonds. Nothing strange there. The fish can change sex, something that occurs in some fish species. As per usual, reproduction is more metabolically costly for the female than the male. So the fish in a pair take turns being the more expensive female. Say fish A and fish B have been doing their sex change tango, and most recently A was the expensive female and B the cheap male. Suppose B cheats by staying male, forcing A to continue as female. A switches to male and stays that way until B regains his social conscience and becomes female. Another widely cited study suggested a tit-for-tat strategy among stickleback fish. The fish is in a tank, and on the other side of a glass partition is something scary, a bigger cichlid fish. The stickleback tentatively darts forward and back, investigating. Now put a mirror in its tank, perpendicular to the axis of the two fish. In other words, thanks to the mirror, there appears to be a second cichlid next to the first. Terrifying, except from out of nowhere, there's this mysterious second stickleback who checks out the second cichlid every time our hero checks out the first. I have no idea who this guy is, but we're an amazing coordinated team. Now convince the stickleback his partner is defecting. Angle the mirror so that the stickleback's reflection is deflected backward. Now when the fish darts forward, his reflection does as well, but that jerk, It looks like he's hanging back safely. Lagging back even half a body length decreases the likelihood of a fish being predated. When the fish believes his partner is defecting, he stops darting forward. Greater complexity in tit-for-tatting is suggested by some animals having multiple roles in their social groups. Back to the playback technique with lions, where the roar of a strange male emanated from a speaker in the bushes or from a life-sized model of a lion. Lions tentatively came forward to investigate, a risky proposition. Consistently, certain lions hung back. The toleration of these habitual scaredy-cats seemed to violate the demands of reciprocity, until it was recognized that such animals took the lead in other domains, e.g. in hunts. A similar punchline emerges concerning the Damaraland mole rat. The social groups of it and its relative, the naked mole rat, resemble those of social insects, with non-reproductive workers and a single breeding queen. Researchers noted some workers who never worked and were considerably fatter than the rest. It turns out that they have two specialized jobs. During the rains, they dig through flooded, collapsed tunnels of the burrows, and when necessary, they disperse with the risky task of starting a new colony. I'm not convinced that a tit-for-tat reciprocity has been clearly demonstrated in other species, but evidence of its strict use would be hard for